Met her briefly one time.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability to order. It is Monday, February 15th, and we have two Senate bills up for public hearing and possible work session. I think my intent is probably just to have the public hearings today and work these bills on Wednesday. And I'd like to take go from the bottom and go up. By popular request, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1013A. Patrick, would you give us a brief little summary of Senate Bill 1013A?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1013A stipulates that the requirement to provide certain notices to tenants of foreclosed properties that apply only to residential tenants of those properties. It prescribes the form to be used for the required notice. It specifies that if a tenant elects, and all this is a separate provision, I'm sorry, it specifies that if a tenant elects to apply prepaid rent or a security deposit to their rent obligation, the purchaser of the property at a trustee sale is not obligated to return the security deposit or prepaid rent to the tenant. The measure has an emergency clause and would take effect upon passage. And I should note no fiscal revenue impact of this measure, and the measure came out of the Senate on a 28-2 vote.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We have up John Van Landingham and Sybil Hebb, please. Welcome to the committee this afternoon, and if you'd identify yourself for the record before you speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center. With me is Sybil Hebb of the Oregon Law Center. This bill, 1013, mainly does or entirely does a couple of cleanup corrections from a bill that was passed in 2009. That bill addressed the situation of residential tenants who are renting typically a home, a single-family home, and the landlord goes into default and is foreclosed upon. The tenant's not doing anything wrong. The tenant's paying the rent, performing the tenant's duties all along, but the tenant gets evicted as part of the foreclosure. That's been the case in Oregon law for quite a while. In the last session, the bill that you all passed gave that tenant some rights, clarified the rights and responsibilities of the lender in the foreclosure. This bill tries to clean up some things that Sybil and I, one, got wrong, and two, overlooked, and three, make the notice of the tenants read better. So the first thing, Sybil's giving you a handout, the first thing is that there's a statutory notice in the 2009 law. After the session, Sybil and I met with Jim Marquis on behalf of the lenders to talk about how this was working, blah, blah, blah. Marquis said he couldn't understand the tenant notice. So we agreed and went back and have rewritten it with the excellent help from Legislative Council to try to make it clearer. So that's the first thing that this bill does. The second thing is that the intent all along was that this notice to tenants only go to residential tenants. The foreclosure statutes address both kinds of tenants, commercial tenants, someone who rents a storefront, for example, and residential tenants. And we dropped out a subparagraph reference to make it clear that this notice to residential tenants only goes to residential tenants, not also commercial tenants. So that's the second fix that will help lenders. Because they were concerned that commercial tenants were going to be confused about getting this notice. The third fix is that the notice of foreclosure, notice of sale, has to be published. Even if you get personal service on the debtor and the tenant, the state law still requires that the notice of foreclosure be published in a newspaper. It doesn't make any sense that the notice of foreclosure publication include the notice of the tenants. Since they're not going to be reading the newspaper, it's not their real property. So to help lenders, we are limiting how long the publication has to be. Then finally, the thing that Patrick described that's a little bit confusing is that current Oregon law has for almost ever, I think, provided that in a residential tenancy, when a landlord sells the property, the new landlord is responsible for the security deposit. Oregon law does not require that security deposits be held in an escrow account. No interest, nothing. It's just that it's the landlord's obligation to refund the security deposit at the end of the tenancy. And there's a statute that has forever said that the new landlord is responsible. In the 2009 bill, we made it clear that lenders who foreclose and become a landlord are not responsible for that deposit. So the last thing this bill does is try to make that clearer than we did in 2009. I'm afraid I may have confused things more than I hope to make. Again, there was no testimony in the Senate except for me and Sybil. The opposition on the Senate floor was by two senators that we believe were concerned about the 2009 bill and not this bill. This bill actually helps lenders as well as tenants. That's
Thank
it.
You. Chair Hovey, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center. I don't have anything to add to Mr. Van Lanningham's explanation except to thank the committee for their attention. I think it's a good bill.
Questions from the committee?
I guess I'll throw a question just for fun.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just you guys got all dressed up, came all this way. And we're confident that the kind of notices we have and the kind of tenants that would be exempted, you know, that we won't have people that would have benefited by these notices from not getting us. I just want some assurances that there aren't, you know, some sort of low revenue commercial leaseholders or owners that actually would benefit by, or you know, that would act much more like a residential tenant than like a traditional commercial tenant.
Chair Hovey, Representative Smith, I'm not aware of any situations of which this change would hurt commercial tenants. The notice that we drafted that's in the statute is entirely aimed at residential tenants and talks about their rights as residential tenants. For example, one of their rights is that during the foreclosure period, they have the right, since they're not going to get a deposit back, I mean, presumably if the landlord is being foreclosed upon, he or she is not going to be refunding the deposit. And we're not making the lender who forecloses be responsible for the deposit. The tenant in these situations is typically going to lose the deposit. So one of the rights that the 2009 law has is that the tenant, during the foreclosure period, can apply the deposit to ongoing rent against the landlord. Great. So some recovery. But that is not a right that a commercial tenant has. So given the notice to a commercial tenant would only confuse a commercial tenant, it might be of value if commercial tenants had a lobbyist and had their own bill that had some rights, but that's not us.
Okay. Thanks.
Other questions? I have one. Maybe you can help clarify this for me. So in the event that the deposit, the security deposit, does not apply to foreclosure sale purchasers, what would happen to a tenant's deposit in a foreclosure sale purchase if they weren't able to recover it? I mean, is there any provision for them?
Chair Hovey, there, other than what I just described, there isn't. Sybil and I have made a list of other issues that we might want to try to work with the lending industry to address in the 2011 session, but those are substantive things. This is not meant to be a substantive bill. It's meant to be sort of a cleanup bill. But right now, unless they can apply their deposit against the ongoing rent, they will lose that deposit. Those tenants will.
Okay. Clarifies that for me. Any other questions? Not seeing any.
I've got one, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there as many situations as there are renters regarding eviction? I just wanted a little clarification. Foreclosure always means eviction, never means eviction.
So Chair Hovey, Representative Gilliam, the 2009 bill addresses the possibility that lenders would continue the tenancy. That would be our preference, because the person is living there and complying with the rental agreement and doing what he or she is supposed to do. But what you hear from lenders is that they, in order to sell the house, they would like the house to be empty. So in those cases, if that's what they want to do, the 2009 law makes it clear that they have to give at least a 30-day notice. There's a part of the complication here is that Congress, in May of last year, adopted a law, it has some odd name.
Foreclosure Prevention for Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure Act.
And that requires a 90-day notice, but it has a sunset. So we have overlapping state and federal laws, and that creates some confusion as well. But, yes, there are different situations, and, in fact, one of the situations that's of interest to us is that sometimes people will give their home back rather than force the lender to go through the foreclosure process. So a short sale or a deed in lieu. And in those cases, there is no protection for those tenants. They don't get any 30-day notice. It's not really addressed. That's something that we hope to talk to the lenders about for 2011, but not this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you for letting us get dressed up. I wanted to note for Representative Krieger that I was on the South Coast this morning, and it was lovely. Sunny, clear, no wind.
How would you do that? Here we are in Salem.
Cruel thing.
I didn't pick up any boats.
I appreciate you letting Representative Krieger know that.
That's why I'm here.
Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1013A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1002. It's not my intent to work either of these two bills yet. I'm going to work them on Wednesday committee. I have to admit that I hadn't really fully got a chance to look through them, even though they seem pretty innocuous. I wanted a little more time to think about them.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Lou Savage. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm actually pinch hitting for Teresa Miller, but I think I can walk you through this bill. If you have any questions, we can come back during the work session. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1002, which proposes to increase the Oregon Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Fund limit for annuities from $100,000 to $250,000. As you probably know, annuities are fairly complex investment products where an insurance company pays a consumer income at regular intervals in return for premium payments made either in a lump sum or over time. The payments can begin immediately or they can be at a future date. And annuities, also, as you probably know, are often marketed to seniors. Just like bank deposits are insured by the FDIC, there's actually a fund for annuities and other insurance products called the Oregon Guarantee Association Fund. And again, they protect a number of insurance products. So the way this works is if an insurance company becomes insolvent, the Guarantee Association collects assessments from other insurance companies to ensure that consumers receive the promised payments, just like in the bank situation. And the coverage limits vary depending upon the type of insurance. Although annuities have grown in the number of sales, the number of annuities that are sold, and the amount of the annuities themselves, the fund limit has not grown. It's currently at $100,000, much lower than the $250,000 that the FDIC coverage limit has, as well as the level recommended by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, which is also $250,000. Many states, including Washington and Idaho, have much higher limits than Oregon does. So what SB 1002 will do is to raise that limit to $250,000, and we believe will provide more confidence to insurers about the safety of their investment and also create consistency for consumers as they manage their money, because the limit would be in line with the FDIC coverage, and also give producers and salespeople in Oregon the opportunity to compete with folks in Washington and Idaho. So with that, I will conclude my testimony and be happy to answer whatever questions I'm able to.
Questions from the committee on annuities.
I should also say, Mr. Chair, that the industry does not oppose this bill. We've spoken to them about this, and they understand the need to protect consumers. And to the extent that this is a confidence builder for their industry, this is something that they understand.
Representative Smith,
as I see, part of the background argument for the bill is that we haven't raised it since, I think it was 1991, and it's raised in other states. What is it in those other states?
Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, it really does vary. There is no state that's lower than $100,000. Most are approaching the $250,000 because of the recommendation by the NAIC. I couldn't give you a number, but we certainly could get that for you.
That'd be helpful. That'd be helpful. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
What's the potential, if you were, and the room is relatively empty at this point, I've noticed, although I'm sure there's throngs of people watching this hearing on television.
Throngs.
But if there were opposition to the bill, what would be the risk or the cost? Why wasn't it $250,000 before? Why wasn't there a sunset, an index in it? I mean, is there, what's the extent there is any risk, any cost in having an infinite limit, or, $250,000 or $300,000 or whatever?
Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, what will happen if a company goes insolvent and can't make payment on the annuity is that the other insurers will pay into the fund to bring that fund up to a level that there's money to pay out if necessary. So this is not, that's a good point too, because this is not a situation where companies will be assessed on an annual basis. It's only if the fund itself needs replenishment to ensure that if consumers are faced with a situation where their company is insolvent, that money will be there.
Final.
Does
it? My. I'm still not sure. What bad it would do, and maybe that means it would do no bad. My guess, though, is if the insured level is 100,000 now and it goes up to 250,000, that the typical size of an annuity will go from smaller to larger if a larger share is insured, in the same way that FDIC insurance will prompt, and we have been advised, things I've been involved in, to put our money in more than one bank when we had more than the FDIC insured amount to put in a bank. But what can you say?
Yeah.
Tell us about that?
Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, I think that's right. I think there will be an opportunity to put a more sizable chunk into an annuity. Of course, there are all kinds of decisions that a consumer would need to make to determine whether that annuity was suitable. But the problem right now is that there are annuities being written in Oregon over that $100,000 limit. So if, in fact, a company should go insolvent, the fund is capped at $100,000 with respect to how much a consumer could get back. So I don't want to overstate this, but there are potentially some consumers at risk now if we don't raise the fund.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And just along that same line of questioning, so this limit, does the insurer normally match what's in the fund dollar for dollar for what kind of benefit they're obligated to pay out, or is there a different ratio?
Chair Holvey, there is a different ratio. I could not give you that number today, but just like the FDIC, the amount of the fund is based on a calculation which would protect against immediate insolvency, and then just like the FDIC, if that level goes below a certain level, then the insurers in this case would be required to replenish the fund.
So does the history show that essentially the amount of the annuities that are purchased do they all pay out at full value, or do some not?
Chair Holvey, I'm not sure what the question is. I mean, if the question is a consumer protection issue with respect to whether these are good investments, I think that's a different discussion. And I would bring someone in on that. There, as you probably know, we have suitability rules for insurance, and there are some fairly strict requirements as to what an agent can match a consumer with respect to whether it's suitable, and annuities are very tricky. And in fact, there is a question nationally as to whether annuities ought to be regulated as a security or as an insurance product. We are fortunate in this state in that both the insurance division and the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities are both under the Department of Consumer and Business Services, so that jurisdictional issue does not exist in Oregon.
So are you saying that both agencies within DCBS regulate annuities, the insurance division and finance and
to
securities?
To the extent that part of the annuity piece is an investment, that's right.
Thank you. Other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for your testimony.
You got to ask if anyone in the audience wants to testify.
Go for it.
Well, this I know it is a fascinating subject.
This is a different.
Raising the threshold for annuities.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1002. Committee, we will be having a meeting on Wednesday. We'll probably work these two bills and potentially have a public hearing on yet another bill. And so with that, anything for go to the order? Not seeing anything, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability.